Hello, it's Thursday the 1st of July. I'm Andrew Pearce and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Love Island, it's back with the usual lineup of critics. Some say it amounts to soft porn. Others say it's just great good fun. I wouldn't know. I've never watched it. Huge boost for the economy. Nissan announces major new factory in Sunderland. What's going on at Wimbledon? The players keep slipping over. We're going to be talking about the fact that we're probably, if you're over 50 and vulnerable, or over 50 as well as vulnerable, you will be given booster jabs at the same time as flu jabs come the autumn. But first, Harry and William reunited. But how united are they as they unveiled the statue to their mother, Princess Diana, on what would have been her 60th birthday? The statue is in Kensington Gardens. A statue of Princess Diana has been unveiled today in Kensington Gardens on what would have been her 60th birthday. The private ceremony was attended by both Prince William and Prince Harry, but all eyes were as much on the pair of the boys as much as the statue, because the feud continues between them. Will they be able to bury the hatchet for the sake of their mother? The royal biographer Angela Levin joins me now. Angela, can I ask you first of all, what do you think of the statue of Diana?
Well, I can't see Diana in the statue. I understand that she's got arms around three children rather than two. At least one is hiding behind the little girl. And I think that showing really that her interest was in looking after children, whoever they were and whatever colour they were. The little boy was obviously had African hair. But I can't recognise her face somehow.
No, I had the same
problem. It looks a bit wooden to me. It looks a bit like you might see. He does all the sculptor Ian Rank Broadley. He does all the Queen's head on the coins, and it looked a bit like a coin face.
Yeah,
if you see what I mean.
But I
thought it was incredibly moving. I was pleased she didn't. She wasn't sitting on a bench, otherwise it would have been all about Meghan. And I'm pleased she was standing there looking very dignified and upright and positive and confident. So she was taken, you know, in her later years, and I think that's very good. I just didn't quite see that. But I think it's hard to do that with a bronze statue if you've known somebody and seen them and see how expressive their face is. Maybe you can't see that. But what was very impressive, I thought, were that the two princes behaved impeccably. And it was a credit to their mother, because she tried to bring them up with the best manners, particularly if they were being watched by the public. And I thought they did behave very well.
Don't you think as well, Angela, Princess Diana would be heartbroken to think about this feud that's divided these two brothers? We don't know if it's going to be fixed. There's a lot of work to be done to fix it.
I think that would have upset her more than anything, because they were her life, really. Thousands of other children were part of her life, but these two were the key to her life. And she was always saying that she loved them to death, and she loved them enormously and very demonstrative. And I think she would be heartbroken. I actually feel that it's not going to make much difference. It's okay to do this about the statue of their mother that had been working on for 4 years. And I was delighted to see they did a short, moving joint statement. But there's so much that's gone on, and I think whatever Harry decides, Meghan will change it, will make it a negative thing to happen. And I don't see that there will be a long-term progress there.
Yeah, you just wonder how long it will be before a story is briefed in the United States that Meghan wasn't welcome at the unveiling of the statue.
Well, they'll come up with something. They might not come up with that, because a lot of people would have said, look, she's only had a baby a very few weeks ago. It would have risked her health, particularly with COVID around. I think anyone could get away with that. And I think she stayed at home deliberately because she's have got a very small baby. But I think there will be some nasty comments about it, you know, perhaps. William pulled the green cloth harder than Harry and left him to fold it up. I think there'll be... But I think, seriously, it is a very big thing. I mean, what Harry has done and said about William, the royal family, and his father, and the Queen. You can't just brush over that. You can put a plaster on it for half an hour, but you can't really get rid of that unless there's a huge amount of conversations over a long time. And Harry does what he's told. If Meghan tells him how to make a statement, he'll make it, and that's it. So it's not just convincing Harry. And he can't afford now to upset Meghan, because he would feel such a failure and a misery. So, you know, and she'd give him what for, really. Yeah. And I think that there's no chance of that.
And it was initially going to be a public event, the unveiling of this statue, but it was made private, and it's in a lovely position. It's going to be in the sunken garden at Kensington Palace, which was one of the princess's favourite spots. 4,000 yes. flowers planted around it, including forget-me-nots, which were her favourite. But the decision to take it private was, we understand, Harry didn't want it to become a great media circus, because as we've discussed before, Angela, he's a great critic of the British media.
Yes, he hates the British media. He wouldn't let any of them come along. He said that it would have to be one reporter, one photographer, and one cameraman. Otherwise, he's not coming. You see, I think all this sort of laying down laws is part of his determination to be a royal family, a royal, but in a very different way, a Californian way, where he is the person who is going to continue Diana's work more than anyone. I was quite shocked when he was saying, you know, again, there's a large part of Diana in me, and she believed that the world would be changed by youth, and she loved the youth. And Meghan and I are doing exactly this. We're getting compassion to the world, and we want to, we're on the brink of change, and young people are going to take over, and Meghan and I are doing this and doing that. And I thought, hang on, he's making the speech that puts Prince William second, and I think it's because he's fed up with being the spare to the heir, and he wants to be strong and powerful, so he's making these demands, small and not so small, and he's going to build up his capacity to do that, I fear. He's competing with his brother and his father to be the better royal and to be more like Diana. And if the public want to care about Diana, they must follow him. Where it's nonsense, because William is also a son and he adored his mother, but he does it in a different way. He brings her into his life in a practical way. And he said, I don't want what's happened to her to break me. I want it to make me. So he sees it in a positive journey. They both are humanitarians. They both want to do that. But Harry and Meghan want to get tremendous praise and often money for what they do, whereas Prince William is trying to be accessible to people and understand people with problems and issues. And it's not about him, it's about them. And I see that as a huge difference. But I think it's competition time with Harry, and at last he can be very strong-minded and lay down, throw the gauntlet down. That's going to be very difficult for the royal family, I think, to handle.
Yeah, I think that's the case. That's the royal biographer Angela Levin talking about the new statue, Princess Diana, which is in Kensington Gardens, which would have been her 60th birthday. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So could COVID jabs be administered much like the flu vaccine, with booster shots every winter for over 50s and those in vulnerable groups? Government scientists are today recommending a third dose to be rolled out for those groups from September. So how would it work? Paul Hunter is Professor of Medicine at the University of East Anglia, and he predicted this would come some months ago, and I'm delighted to say he joins me now. Professor Hunter, you've been on the money on this the whole way through. Part of the reason I assume the government bought so many more vaccines than we would have known for the first rollout was because they knew booster jabs might be required when the colder weather comes.
Yeah, I think, well, we never knew for certain, but I think the evidence was fairly clear for quite a few months that we would need at least one round of boosters in this winter, particularly for the more vulnerable. And effectively, that's what the government has announced. Everybody over 50 and people with other clinical vulnerabilities will be offered a booster dose, probably at the same time as they are called in for their influenza shots. But the injections won't be this. There won't be one injection, I'm afraid. You will have, if this is what happens, you'll go in and you'll have one injection of the flu and one injection of COVID, possibly in different arms, possibly at different parts of the same arm.
Now, what about this, Professor? So I had, being of a certain age, of course, I've had both my jabs, and I had AstraZeneca. Mm-hmm. Will it be important when we get the booster jab, because I would be entitled to one, that we have the same vaccine, or doesn't it matter?
Well, I think that is the big question that we're waiting to hear the advice on at the moment. My guess is that there will be an encouragement to have a different vaccine for the booster. In the last couple of days, a couple of papers have come out of the Oxford group, one of which looked at mixing and matching different vaccines, but only for the first and second dose. And what they found is that if you had a first dose of the AstraZeneca vaccine, then swapping to the Pfizer vaccine for your second dose actually gave you quite a bit higher levels of protection as measured by antibodies and that sort of thing. And although we don't know that for certain for the third booster, I think it's quite likely. So my guess is that we would be encouraged, particularly I think if we'd had the AstraZeneca vaccine initially, to have the Pfizer vaccine for the third booster. But on the other hand, there has been more data as well showing that even if you can't get the Pfizer vaccine, if you have the AstraZeneca vaccine, that does still give you an improved levels of antibodies, a third dose of the AstraZeneca vaccine, than if you didn't have a third dose.
Are you confident, Professor, that the vaccines have broken that link between hospitalizations and fatalities? Because while we know the huge increase in number of infections, the number of deaths is still often in single figures.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the trouble is, I'm never quite sure what people mean when they say broken the link.
Right.
If cases go up, hospitalizations and deaths will go up.
Yeah.
But what we're seeing is that they don't go up anywhere near to the same level was the case in the second wave. And that is down to two things. One is the vaccine is making it the case that relatively few people who've had vaccine are getting infected. Some are. So most of the cases that we're seeing now are in quite young people. The average age, or the midpoint age, is less than 25. So more than half of the people getting the infection at the moment are under 25 years old. And that group don't get that sick on balance, and they rarely need to go into hospital, and they very rarely succumb. So that's one thing. But the other thing is that even if you do get an infection and you've had vaccines, the chances of you going into hospital and the chances of you dying are substantially less than if you'd got the infection and you hadn't been vaccinated.
Just finally, Professor, it looks pretty clear now. The Prime Minister has been out and about today, very robust about Freedom Day, so-called July the 19th. The Secretary of State for Health, Sajid Javid, I'm pretty convinced he said to the Prime Minister he'd only take the job if restrictions are lifted on July the 19th. Do you think after that day comes, if indeed it does, we'll still be required to wear masks? And if we're not required to, perhaps would you recommend that we do?
Yeah, personally, the first thing to say is that I do think it's the right decision to go through step four on the 19th of July and lift most, if not all, of the remaining restrictions that we're living under. After that point, I will be somewhat more choosy about wearing masks. I think the rules, the legal rules for wearing masks will be removed in most contexts. I suspect that there will be quite a few people who still actually feel more comfortable if they're wearing a mask. And if that's the case, then, you know, absolutely fine for them. Personally, after that date, I probably won't wear a mask unless I'm in somewhere that's really crowded indoors, and then, you know, I might, yeah, maybe I will. But in most contexts, I personally won't wear a mask, even in if I'm wearing them at the moment in because one has to.
Fine. Very interesting. That's Paul Hunter. He's Professor of Medicine at the University of East Anglia. Thanks for joining us. Why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, you tweet us at mailplus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. So from today, employers are going to have to pay 10% of their furloughed workers' usual wage. The government will continue to pay the other 70%. With about 1.5 million workers still on furlough, the change will affect thousands of firms across the country, and it's going to continue to cost taxpayers billions of pounds. So when does furlough end completely, and what do we think of the fact employers are now having to contribute? I'm joined now by Jeevan Sander, who's an economist at King's College London and a former Treasury official. Jeevan, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, in his big Mansion House speech, making the point that furlough has been widely praised, a very imaginative scheme. He thinks it's the envy of the world, but it's costing an absolute packet for the taxpayer.
Well, look, the Chancellor's absolutely correct. It was a brilliant scheme. You know, I think around 9 million people on furlough at the peak of the pandemic. Had it not been for that scheme in place, we'd have seen mass unemployment and the damage that causes. We should remember that the places we think about levelling up to are the same place that suffered mass unemployment in the 1980s. They haven't recovered for 30 or even 40 years in some cases. So it was the right call. It has cost a lot, but the way to think about this is about what's the benefit of that. And the benefit of that was to stop mass unemployment. It was a very good idea at the time, and the Treasury should be congratulating themselves on that.
Now, what of employers? They will be squealing, won't they? Because the cost of keeping a staff on the scheme is going to rise to, for them, from £155 a month, covering national insurance, to £322 in July and virtually £500 in August and September when furlough is finally wound down. Will some of these companies that may be already struggling on the borderline of whether they can continue, could this not push some companies into financial ruin?
It could push them into financial ruin. It certainly also would probably lead to job losses as well. We saw last year when the Chancellor first started to ask firms to contribute and then began to think about winding down the scheme, we did start to see people being laid off. I think we're looking at something like a third of those businesses currently forced to remain closed, like nightclubs, are saying they have little to no confidence that they will survive. So it certainly will threaten their kind of ability to get through this moment. The other problem is that we sit here today on the 1st of July. Restrictions are the same as they were yesterday in June. So why are firms getting less support? Firms can't open up any more than they are at the moment. Social distancing guidelines are still in place. So fundamentally, it was, in my view, the wrong decision for the government to do so. They should have kept the scheme in its current form, at least until people could technically socially interact again when the restrictions are released.
And of course, we're pretty clear, aren't we, that the restrictions are going to be released on lifted on July the 19th. So it wouldn't have been such a long period, would it, to wait?
It wouldn't at all. And by the way, the cost is very low. So I think at the moment, Chancellor probably saves around £300 million with this cut to furlough against a total cost of £65 billion. I mean, It's pennies on the pound. It's a really, you know, it's a penny wise, pound foolish approach to policy. You're not saving a lot of money doing it, but you are risking unemployment and business bankruptcies in the process. So like you say, another 3 weeks really wouldn't have been that bad.
And of course, Dishy Rishi, as we call him, he likes being popular. He's probably the most popular Chancellor of the Exchequer there's been in modern history. Chancellors tend to be popular when they give money away. Perhaps his halo will slip a bit if we start getting headlines of firms going under because employers say we simply cannot afford to pay this 10% off the furlough.
Yeah, I mean, this is certainly a dangerous moment. I mean, the other thing we should think about is you know, we have been protected from the economic consequences of this pandemic, or at least anyone who was on a low income was protected. People saw their savings rise. People saw their house prices rise. It's those people at the bottom who really have suffered during this pandemic. But the other side of it is also, how will this economy recover? Because whilst the virus is circulating, it's not clear if social interaction or economic activity will recover to the same levels as before. I mean, you had, you know, an unlocking. We can go to the pub, and yet we see the visits to retail and hospitality venues are about 20 to 30% lower than they were prior to the pandemic. I mean, I love the pub, but even I'm a little bit wary at the moment, knowing there's over 20,000 cases a day. So it is certainly a much more dangerous period for the economy as that support is pulled away, and also will have implications for the troubles of popularity.
All right, that's Jeevan Sander, who's an economist at King's College London, and he was, of course, a senior official at the Treasury. Thanks for joining us. Well, we can't get enough of Matt Gatwood this week. It is a busy week with the Euros and, of course, Wimbledon. And Wimbledon, the story, apart from Andy Murray, of which we'll talk about in a bit, is not so much about the quality of the tennis, it's the quality of the courts, because players keep being upended, with Serena Williams, no less, actually retiring hurt. What's wrong with the courts, Matt?
Well, yeah, the courts are a bit slippy. They're a bit slidey. They're a bit of a greasy surface on them this year so far. I mean, they seem to be better so far today in the play we've had today, because it's a slightly warmer day today. So that will have taken some of the moisture out. But in the first few days, obviously the roof has been on a lot of the court, on court, centre court and court one. So that obviously traps the moisture. We've had a lot of, rain around as well. And also these courts haven't been played on. You got to remember that normally they would have been played on last year. So these courts are sort of even fresher, if you like, because they've had 2 years without any tennis on. So that explains the kind of great pictures around in the mail today of people doing the splits and people screaming in agony. Some of them obviously more agony than others, and some maybe even playing on it a bit more than others, like Nick Kyrgios, who you'll know is the Aussie bad boy.
Very unpredictable player.
Unpredictable, loves a bit of drama. He went down screaming in agony. If you'd seen him the way he went down, you'd think he'd never walk again. And then 2 minutes later, he was running around the baseline. So, but it's been interesting. But it does look like it may be, as obviously the more they're played on, the less grass there is.
And of course,
isn't.
There was no play last year, of course, on those courts.
Exactly,
they've not been used for 2 years.
Exactly. So that is another thing, that they've had more time to grow, and so they're not quite. That's making them more slick as well. So, but I think we're through the worst of it. So we managed to have got through it. And I think Serena had existing injuries anyway. Yeah. I don't think her withdrawal was entirely down to slipping on the court, carrying a few injuries into the tournament. Yeah. Sorry, that's my phone going off.
That is Matt Gatwood's mobile phone, just in case you wonder what that noise was.
Sorry about that.
We weren't playing music background. Are they embarrassed at the All England Club about the courts? It's just one of those things.
They don't seem to be. I mean, I think that's one of those things that, you know, there would be complaints that if the grass was really short and cut really fine, there would be complaints at the end that there's not enough grass on the course. If you got to the end of the second week and they were all just dirt, they'd be saying, well, what's going on here? There's not enough grass. So they're a bit of a can't win situation. Yeah. Djokovic was quick to point out yesterday that, you know, he had no problem with it, and he was one of the people who lost his footing a couple of times. Mm. It does tend to happen, but I think in this instance...
Happens in football. Matches.
Happens in football matches. And rugby. It's not nice when you're trying to change direction quickly and push off, and you can do yourself a mischief. But I think that mostly they think it's one of those things, and it's an extreme set of circumstances that's led to this situation.
And talking of extreme set of circumstances, Andy Murray, who's virtually the bionic man, he's been rebuilt after so many operations. Another five-set thriller. He went over a few times too. I'd never heard of the bloke he beat, but I did chuckle when I realised he'd beat a German. So we beat Germany twice this week.
We did, yeah. Well, Scotland obviously beat Germany, with Murray being Scottish. So
We'll take him as
British. He's definitely British this week till he goes out.
Yeah.
But, as ever with Murray, you know, it's never straightforward.
No.
He won in four sets in the first round.
Yeah.
Last night he was 2-1 down. Then they put the roof on. And then he came out a different player, and he was superb. You know, the tennis he played in the last set was brilliant. Yeah. Some great drop shots, wonderful lobs. As ever, admonishing himself all the time, telling himself off, shouting up at his box, sort of constantly, goading himself on to do better, do more. And it's always drama, and it's always brilliant. But he did play well. how much that's taken out of him ahead of playing the number 10 seed, probably on Friday,
which
remains
be
to be seen.
What's
which
the number
will
10
be
seed
to,
called?
To Shapolov.
Oh, right.
He is going to be tough. He's a hard-hitting, decent player. So that could be a tough test for Murray if that game comes to pass. Again, he could take us till 10:30 at night into a five-setter, but we'll see. But yeah, it depends how he said he felt good after the game. He gave a nice interview afterwards. He was very... It was great, on great form afterwards, giving his shirt to a Scottish fan in the crowd and stuff. So, he's back again, and we'll see him on Friday night. Let's hope that's not the end of it. It'd be brilliant if he can get into the second
week.
Yeah,
yeah. And we shouldn't forget Cameron Norrie, who's our number two or three. Yeah. He's still going strong, isn't he?
He's going strong. He, as we speak, has two sets to love up. So he will play, if everything goes according to form, he will play Federer. In the next round on Friday.
Oh, no.
So, I know. Who would you want to win that?
No hesitation whatsoever.
Federer.
Roger. Of course.
Shocking.
Yeah.
So, that's great. So he's doing well. So, you know, there's a few Brits hanging in there, so it's good.
Good. All right. That's Matt Gatwood, who's Deputy Sports Editor, with his mobile phone.
Thank you.
Well, a huge announcement today, which will send all sorts of share prices soaring, because Nissan has confirmed what we've been expecting for a very long time, a major new factory in Sunderland. It's to build batteries for electric cars, 1,600 new jobs, thousands more will be created in the local economy. Hugo Duncan, who is, of course, the Daily Mail's Deputy Business Editor, joins me now. Hugo, this is a huge shot in the arm for the British economy, and those of us who voted for Brexit, like me, were quite heartened to hear the boss of Nissan saying that Brexit great opportunities for them to invest in Britain.
Well, that's right, Andrew. And of course, Sunderland was an area of the country that also backed Brexit in the referendum 5 years ago. Now, around that time, you will, of course, recall, you know, we were told that a vote for Brexit was effectively a vote for the closure of this Nissan plant, which has been such a success story there since it opened in the 80s.
Yeah.
5 years on, quite the opposite. Nissan have today announced a £1 billion investment in the area. Not only are they saying they're going to build a new all-electric vehicle there, which is, of course, absolutely crucial for the future of the car industry and the local economy, but also a giant new gigafactory is going to be built there to make batteries for these vehicles. This is an enormous vote of confidence in the British economy post-Brexit. It's an enormous vote of confidence in Sunderland and the car industry there in particular.
And Hugo, if you could explain, when Britain was in the European Union, there were very, very prescriptive rules and regulations about state aid to try to attract inward investment. We're now no longer part of the European Union, and the British government did commit serious amounts of money to luring Nissan, if you like, into making this big investment.
Well, I mean, that is correct. Nissan themselves are putting in hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds, but the British government is also investing in order for this factory to be built. And there is talk that this sort of investment could be replicated in other parts of the country. Of course, the car industry has really struggled in the last 18 months or more. Now, not all of this is because of COVID. Not all of it is because for a huge length of time, you know, car showrooms were shut and factories were not building as many cars as they could because we had to be, COVID safe. It was also because we knew as consumers, as drivers, we knew that the transformation to electric vehicles was coming. And under those circumstances, there's not many who want to go out and buy a new petrol or diesel car. So the car industry has really been struggling to work out what it is going to do to A, get over COVID, but B, more importantly, secure its future for years to come as electric vehicles sort of take over. It's going to be a long process, of course. We don't have enough charging plants and so on. But a huge global company like Nissan, which is, of course, Japanese, it's a Japanese-based firm, but has long had a big presence here in Sunderland. When it commits resources like this and commits to the workforce there that have long been, you know, hailed as one of the best car producing factories, certainly in this country, but you know, and far wider within the whole Nissan enterprise, it really is a vote of confidence in Britain's car industry in the future.
Great news, isn't it? Great news indeed. That's Hugo Duncan, who's Deputy Business Editor at the Daily Mail. Thanks for joining us. So Love Island is back. How could we have stood 15 months without it? It's got the usual lineup of criticism. Some say it's just soft porn, sexual exploitation. Others say it's damaging to the mental health of viewers and participants alike. But the Daily Mail's very fine columnist, Liz Jones, disagrees because she likes it. And she joins me now. Liz, why do you like it?
Oh, God, I'm addicted. There goes every night from 9 o'clock at night and 10 till 10 o'clock. I'm just glued. I've got a lot of admiration for these young people. And I think everyone who criticises Love Island, they're a bit snooty and they probably got lots of money and they probably went to Oxbridge. This programme isn't for you. I don't mean you, Andrew. I mean those snooty people.
Yeah.
There are a lot of young people out there who've missed socialising, who haven't been able to go abroad, who haven't been able to sit by a pool, who haven't met anyone for 15 months. And now they can look through this little window and see young people just like them, not Oxbridge educated, not privileged, just doing their best. And I think it's mean to criticise them because they are doing their best. To get a body like that, because you haven't been privately schooled and you haven't been to Oxbridge, that's probably their only way out. It's their only way of perhaps making a life for themselves. They don't rely on the bank of mum and dad. They're ordinary young people taking pride in themselves and doing their best. And I wish I'd been more like them in my 20s, more confident, more able to wear a bikini, enjoy my body, enjoy my youth. But the thing that gobsmacks me about everyone who criticises Love Island, look at what's going on in Westminster.
Yes, well done, well said.
In offices when they should be running the country. There's no shagging in Love Island. It's not porn. They just have a snog. They go on very chaste dates. They're very polite to each other. They're pretty much, they're barely out of childhood, these people. And they're just being young. And I think commentators who write in newspapers criticising them, they're just jealous they're not young anymore.
Yeah. Have you seen the couple who you think are going to emerge as the winners yet? Do you think you've formed a view? Is it too early?
Well, it's very early days. They keep bringing new people in and the boys' heads keep getting turned. And I feel quite sorry for the boys, actually, because they're no match for the girls. Absolutely. They all look terrified. There are a few front runners. And Aaron has just teamed up with the new girl who comes in. He's a very handsome black young man. And I disagree with the other piece in the Mail today saying that the young black people get chosen last. He got chosen above every other man on the programme. What is refreshing about these young people is they are colourblind. They really are. They just go for whoever they fancy. They're not concerned about race. They're not concerned about what someone does for a living. It's very sort of skin deep, but that's quite refreshing. And they're not racist. Everyone who thinks this country's racist, those young people are a shining example of being completely colourblind. The young black man was chosen above all the other young men. And the other young men are just dyed themselves orange. It's absolutely hilarious. And it's also, it's like a comedy. It's absolutely, you will just die laughing every evening because it's just so funny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And and I like the way there's no one morbidly obese or bucktooth, lots of long eyelashes. But you're always so self-effacing, Liz. I love this. You said when you were 11, you wore sunblock on your hair because you were terrified of aging. On your hair, even when married, you never removed your T-shirt in bed and you didn't wear a bikini until you were 53.
No, I didn't wear. I always wore a cardigan on the beach and jeans. I never exposed my body. And if we were all a bit more Love Island, we'd all have a bit more fun. They don't worry about their careers. They're just having fun. They're having a few weeks off. I wish I'd been more like that, you know. And I've got more time for those girls who pile the makeup on than overconfident girls who don't think they have to bother wearing makeup and they don't think they have to bother ironing their clothes. At least those girls try. They're trying to be the best they can be.
Absolutely. That's Daily Mail columnist Liz Jones, who's written an absolutely fabulous piece about Love Island. Thanks for joining us. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app every weekday at 5 p.m. You can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce.